In our next case, 2022-0993, in the matter of In re E.S. Jr. On behalf of the State of Ohio, Mr. Van. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you're sharing time with the state today?
Yes, that's correct. Mr. Peterson from the Solicitor General's office will be arguing for 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Van. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Cuyahoga County representing the state of Ohio. And with me at council table this morning is Assistant Prosecutor Gregory Ochocki and Samuel Peterson from the Attorney General's office, or Solicitor General's office. And I would reserve 1 minute for rebuttal for myself. Now, moving to our argument here this morning, I'm here today, in this case, to ask this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to remand this matter to the juvenile court to relinquish its jurisdiction over the complaint, to transfer this matter to the grand jury for proper consideration. In doing so here today, I do think there is law for this court to write here today. Now, the dissenting opinion in this case, it indicated it's necessary.
So what would be that law?
And I think where we find ourselves in this case, and I think if we go back to an earlier decision from the 8th District, In re CG, that's cited in paragraph 31, I think one area of that we need clarification is this idea of where deference is due. Now, in the earlier case, In re CG, again in this case, you can look at paragraph 31. What the Court of Appeals did in this case was defer to the credibility determination of the juvenile court. It is the state's position under, you know, our proposition of law that such deference was not due. And I think in area where this court can write about, what this court can do is draw a line between, let's say, there's a difference between credible evidence and whether a theory of the case is credible or plausible.
So what law would you have us write from this case?
I would have this court write in this case that here that the state's evidence should have been looked at in a light most favorable to the prosecution. And I think the court can expand that where a
but why isn't court, why isn't that we do that after conviction, right?
Sure,
but not before.
And I think what this relates back to what this court last year in State versus Martin indicated that, you know, these proceedings, when we review these proceedings, it's courts are to look at it under a sufficiency standpoint. And so I think that's a take on that sufficient evidence standard of review that applies in this matter.
So should we reverse and send it back for the court to apply Martin?
No, Your Honor, although that is one avenue that this court can take, I, in our view, that the state certainly presented sufficient and credible evidence here. There wasn't
so what,
too
but shouldn't
much.
Shouldn't the court determine that first? You'd want us to make that determination?
I think this court, I would ask this court, as it had done in Iacona, to do so. The remand in Iacona, I recall, was reversing and remanding it for proper transfer. So I think there is precedent for this court to do so.
Except, do you just really want error correction here because there wasn't enough deference to the state?
Your Honor, I would say that any time the state or a defense attorney brings a case here, there's always some claim of errors. And going back to how I opened my argument, I would ask that this court go beyond this kind of concept of just a mere error correction case, because, again, I think there is room here for this court to really distinguish between this idea of deferring to credible evidence and what happened in this case.
Your proposition of law basically says that circumstantial evidence is entitled to the same weight as direct evidence in determining whether there's probable cause. I think we all know that. So where do we go from here? Is there something more nuanced than that?
I think once the court works through the nuances, and certainly I myself have seen propositions of law considered by this court where the proposition indicates something that we all know, but really what we're here about is the issue, and the nuance here is that this court can look at the transcripts of the proceedings and just the manner in which this bindover hearing was conducted, the way in which the juvenile court was very active in questioning of witnesses. It was certainly, in our view, going towards that role as fact finder. In fact, on page 28 of the transcript, the juvenile court even indicated at that point that it was considering a mistrial. I think those concepts are entirely inconsistent with what a bindover proceeding is.
Counsel, let's say we agree with you. Let's say if I put myself in the position of the juvenile trial court judge that you were in front of, that I would have found that you had established probable cause on the claims. But it went up to the Court of Appeals, and two of the three judges thought that it was sufficient. How do we write a decision here that isn't just conceding that we're engaging in error correction because we would have ruled differently?
So I think the way to do this, and certainly we recognize Iacona, this court reiterated to the position in Martin. There's a discussion about, the state has to present credible evidence, but at the same time, the juvenile court shouldn't step into that role as fact finder. Competing theories are left for the fact finder. We don't have to disprove alternative theories. The state's evidence need not be unassailable. And these are things we all know, but yet courts are looking at this court's decision in Iacona. And again, we go back to In Re CG. It's discussed in paragraph 31 of this court, of the 8th District opinion. And again, there's that reference that's out there that's saying, well, we're going to defer to the court's credibility determination. And here, I would say that, that deference wasn't due here. Like, there was credible evidence presented in this case, from the firearm under the front passenger seat that had the appellee's DNA on it. We know the trajectory of the bullet, is consistent with the placement in the car. All of that evidence supports probable cause. And what I would say, again, is that this court should distinguish between, the court's role in determining whether the state has presented sufficient credible evidence, but when there's a question as to whether the state's theory of the case, the legal theory, whether that's plausible, that's not something that is entitled to deference.
Counsel, I've heard the state argue in other cases that we should give deference to the trial court, particularly in suppression cases. And so we should give deference in those cases where a trial court judge denies a motion to suppress, but in a case like this, we're to tell courts of appeals that they don't give deference in probable cause findings?
Well, I would at least say in the context of a suppression case, that's a mixed standard of review. Deference is given to the facts, but the legal analysis that's conducted de novo. And so again, you know, I think what is causing some amount of confusion, what's led to the lower court's, the juvenile court's opinion judgment being affirmed, is this idea that deference should have been given to the court's determination. And that's a little problematic because, you know, the court did not, the juvenile court did not expressly indicate in its judgment anything about credibility. As in In Re CG, I believe what the Court of Appeals had done was look at how active the court was in its manner of questioning witnesses as some sort of inference that the court was questioning some credibility area. But again, I think what we can tell from the record here in this case, and from the court's own concept, it really was questioning the theory. You know, I believe the facts here are fairly straightforward. They support probable cause as to the involuntary manslaughter. And I would remind the court again that, you know, really what was at issue was the proximate cause concept. The juvenile court did not have any issue in finding probable cause as to the fact that the appellee was in a stolen vehicle. It was a stolen Kia that had apparently been used in another offense.
The appellee's the state. The appellee's the state, not the deceased, correct?
Appellee, E.S.
Sorry.
Into the
yes.
Solicitor General's time and your rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you. But again, if there are no further questions for myself, I would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and to remand this for proper transfer. Thank you.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, briefly, because I want to be respectful of the time my colleague has reserved. The state established more than sufficient evidence to establish probable cause in this case. And while I'm happy to entertain any questions, I'd like to address this error.
Let me ask it this way. Assume I agree with you on the facts. Why should this court be taking a pure error case?
And that's exactly where I'd like to go, Your Honor. I have at least three reasons. First, even if this was pure error correction, the error was egregious, and as this court recognized in its Phipps decision, sometimes even error correction is an appropriate role for the court to remind other courts, lower courts, that this court is minding the store, that they can't willfully just disregard or even inadvertently disregard the court's precedent. The court has a summary reversal rule that does just that, and so it acknowledges that sometimes error correction is this court's job.
So should we remand this case back? Should we remand the case for application of Martin?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think if you were to look, and this gets to the second point.
Because neither side had the benefit of Martin before briefing, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think if you look at the transcript of this case, it is a two-day hearing with 13 witnesses and hundreds of exhibits. I think this court can look at that transcript and say, in this case, there is more than sufficient evidence to establish probable cause. Remand would just result in delay, resulting in the same outcome no matter what. I don't think there's any basis to find that probable cause was lacking here, and so I think the court should, in the first instance, resolve it. And the second point I'd like to make about why this case should be decided, why you should reject the call to dismiss it as improvidently allowed, is this is a foundational error. The probable cause hearing is supposed to be a screening function. It is not a high bar. This court has said requires just the state present more than a mere evidence establishing more than a mere suspicion of guilt. And so this goes to every probable cause hearing. And I don't think, again, I point
counsel,
to
counsel, if I agree with you, on this case, the facts of the case, what you just said, should I write the decision if it was given to me to write? Should I concede that we are engaging in error correction, but we need to do this from time to time?
I think that is a fair thing to do, Your Honor. And I think that goes to the third point, which is this court has announced the probable cause standard in a variety of cases, but it has never applied it in any specific case. It has never reviewed a probable cause determination. And so even if you say in your opinion, we're engaging in error correction, what the court would be doing would be modeling for lower courts the type of inquiry that should occur. And Justice Stewart, you asked about the rule to write. I think that is a sufficient rule to say, here is how you should be doing this. This should not be a multi-day hearing. This should be a screening function to determine whether this should go down path A or path B. And so that you may characterize that as error correction. You may characterize that as writing new law demonstrating how to apply this standard. But in either case, we think reversal is appropriate, and we would ask the court to do so.
Mr. Peterson, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Hackett.
Chief Justice Kennedy, counsel, may it please the court. This case is error correction. I think the only real question before the court right now is not a legal one. It's whether this court should exercise its error correction authority. It should not.
Why not just summarily reverse under State v. Martin? It seems pretty clear that the court went well beyond what a court is supposed to do in a probable cause hearing. We could do a summary. We have a summary reverse procedure for a reason. Why not use it here?
Well, I think it's hard to even discern from the state's proposition where exactly they're assigning error. Is it an error in the 8th District's decision and how they apply the appellate standards of review, or is it, as the state seems to focus, an error in the juvenile court's assessment of the facts? So even in the proposition and their request for relief itself, it is not clear exactly what they're looking for, well beyond them, you know, failing to assert an unsettled.
But given that, that doesn't really answer the question of why not summarily reverse it if we think it's wrong.
Well, I don't think the court failed to comply with what Martin requires. I think the 8th District recited this court's legal standards verbatim. They applied this court's standards verbatim and in applying them reached a fact-bound conclusion in line with the juvenile court. So I don't think there's even any misapplication of law to correct, even under Martin. And other reasons, Your Honors, that this court should not exercise its error correction authority is that, touching briefly on the facts, this court normally reserves that authority for exceptional and egregious cases, not marginal ones. In addition to that, I think reversing in a marginal case like this one sends a message that any decision opposing the state is wrong. And the upshot of such a decision and such a precedent is really to strip the juvenile court judges of their actual decision-making authority. If judges are not permitted to judge, you know, it raises the question, what are they there for at all? Worse still, I think the effect is to destabilize this court's jurisprudence. I think it undermines and subverts what this court has said in most recently Martin just last year, which built on and reaffirmed AJS. And it does that by really exploiting the middle ground that AJS and Martin drew. It creates a heads they win, tails kids lose situation in every single case. Taken all together, I think these consequences ultimately lead to manufactured, or at least what appears to be manufactured, predetermined results in every single case, which raises or will raise new constitutional questions about the transfer system on the whole, and predictably even more complex litigation. And so it will do the exact opposite of what the state is requesting, and it will open the floodgates to further litigation, unnecessarily so, again, because there is no error to correct. Regarding, and I
but let me ask another question. I mean, wouldn't, if we didn't give juvenile judges some leeway in determining the issues that they have to for probable cause, for the question of bindover, whether it be mandatory or permissive, we've talked repeatedly in our decisions, Smith and even the precursors to Smith, about the special role of the juvenile court system and the way that juveniles should be treated, because they're not necessarily in the criminal justice system until they're bound over. They're in the juvenile court system. So if we try to do what your opposing counsel suggested, which is to say, here's how you have to do a bindover hearing, and you can't, as a trial judge, be fully satisfied in your decision, aren't we basically going backwards rather than forwards?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, I think a decision in that respect just ties the hands of juvenile court judges. As I said, it really strips them of the authority and their duty, affirmative duty, to do what this court has instructed them to do in AJS and Martin, which is to assess the evidence for credibility, both quality and quantity of the evidence, and make a determination.
But the overarching role of the juvenile court judges and the juvenile system is to rehabilitate them so that they don't become adult offenders, correct?
Absolutely.
And there's a different approach than we take in adult juvenile or adult criminal court.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. And speaking to the state's point and a little bit to Your Honor's question, I just want to clarify that this also doesn't pose a misapplication of law or a question about a misapplication of law under AJS, because it doesn't involve competing theories. I want to quote from the transcript. The state said at the juvenile court hearing, quote, "Your Honor, I don't believe Ms. Kopech has not committed to any sort of defensive theory, and she is certainly under no obligation to do so." That's at page 119. At page 299 of the transcript, the prosecution actually invited the juvenile court to challenge the prosecution with an alternative theory, which of course AJS bars. And the juvenile court judge expressly declined to do so because she said that would require her to assume facts that were not in evidence. So I think the juvenile court judge strove to comply and comport with what this court said in AJS and has done exactly what this court instructed. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, for those reasons, we would ask the court respectfully to dismiss this case as improvidently accepted. If it should not, it should at least affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Vann.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few remarks based upon that. In our view, it is necessary to write something in this case. Of course, we would welcome a summary reversal in light of Martin, but being on the front lines of these types of proceedings, we are dealing with a lot of these probable cause issues, even more so in light of the court's decisions in Smith and Burns. To uphold the proceedings below, if what happened below doesn't satisfy the probable cause standard, then I fear that where we would be left is with many more mini trials, so to speak, as the transcripts show in this case. And that simply isn't the proper standard. And so again, if there are no further questions from this court, I would ask the court to reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals and to remand this matter to the juvenile court for proper transfer over the mandatory offense and charges in the complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll receive a decision from the court.